This is Issues and Ales, the future of education in Alabama. I'm Dan Carson. In the next hour, we'll get deeply into that vital, complex subject, including charter schools.
From looking at the charter school bill that was passed, there are some concerns in there.
Funding. What is properly funded? At what level does that issue get taken off the table?
A reasonable class size.
Facilities. There are some schools, they aren't safe because they were built in the 50s and 60s.
For me, not being in a public system, you know, I sit here and I just think, wow, I wish I had all this money that the public school has.
We're comparing apples and oranges here.
Testing, inequity, and much more. We'll hear from teachers, students, parents, and school leaders of all stripes. It's Issues and Ales, the future of education in Alabama, coming up after this news. This is your NPR News Station, 90.3 WBHM and 91.5 WSGN. I'm Dan Carson. There's no shortage of news coming out of Alabama's school systems. Our educators face challenges common to other states, plus our own unique hurdles. But we have distinctive bright spots and reasons for optimism, too. On the political front, state legislators recently took controversial steps that include allowing charter schools and expanding the Alabama Accountability Act, which, simplifying for now, diverts tax money to private schools. Meanwhile, teachers are frustrated about standardized testing and certification requirements. So what does all this mean for the future of education in Alabama, for the people of Alabama? This Issues and Ales is one of our series of public conversations. Today we're discussing the future of education in Alabama. We're here at WorkPlay in Birmingham and our panelists are ready, so let's get schooled. Educating us tonight, Brooke Elliott is a teacher and technology coordinator at Jemison High School. She has a bachelor's degree in chemistry, a master's in technical education, and more than 15 years experience teaching engineering and career prep. Claire Rivas is a homeschooled ninth grader from Trustville. She's a competitive ice skater who plays piano and violin. Claire also loves astronomy, photography, and literature. Jerry Tate is president of the Phillips Academy PTA and third vice president of the Birmingham Council of PTAs. He also has a daughter in the Birmingham City School System and another at the Alabama School of Fine Arts. As education reporters know, by the way, he's a fixture at school board meetings and other places where important things are happening. Dr. Deborah Voltz of the University of Alabama at Birmingham is dean of the School of Education, director of the Center for Urban Education, and professor in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction. She also took part in our first ever Issues and Ales event about 3.5 years ago. So welcome back, Dr. Voltz. Thank you. My first question is for Brooke Elliott. But with all these questions, the panelists should definitely feel free to jump in. Starting for now with Ms. Elliott, though, you're a teacher, and first of all, thank you for that. You spend a lot of time where education policy hits the ground, so to speak, hits real people. And a lot of teachers I speak with are frustrated. They say it's getting harder and harder to be a teacher. Do you feel that way? And could you explain some of the reasons teachers in general seem to feel that way?
Yes, we are frustrated with how many mandated tests are given to our students today. I've talked with other teachers at my school and other schools, and they've suggested maybe limiting the percentage of testing that we have with our instruction time. I know that the post-secondary schools are looking for the ACT scores, so why are we taking 5 or 6 tests a year? Why aren't we just focusing maybe on one? Also, the teachers that I teach with are trying to work with the Common Core standards, and I know that a lot of you have heard some negative things about the Common Core standards. It's just a learning curve, and it seems like education likes to jump on the bandwagon a lot. They come up with new ideas, we try them for a while, and then they go away. And right now, we have about 3 different entities that are giving us standards. So another thing that I would suggest that we just have one set of standards instead of 3 or 4 for the same subject.
You can get behind the program, but then the program changes.
Right.
I mean, that you still perceive that that's going on still, definitely,
yes.
Here in Alabama?
Yes.
With the backdrop that both reality and perception are important, a question for Claire Rivas. Could you tell us the reasons why you and your family decided to go the homeschool route?
When I've actually been to public school before. I went kindergarten and second grade, and me and my family, we just felt like there was just too much work for kids to be in second grade and not to be able to do the things that they like to do. And so me and my family, we like to do things together. We like to go on field trips, and we like to learn new things. And when we decided to homeschool, we had that in mind. And now it's just helped tremendously because, as you know, I'm a figure skater, and it just helps a lot with the flexibility of hours and just for me to do things that I like to do, like skating, and to do other subjects that I just really enjoy doing and not having to have required things that I may or may not use in the near future.
Okay, thank you. Now a question for Deborah Voltz, and again, other panelists should definitely feel free to jump in. Dr. Voltz, given your expertise in curriculum, urban education, and more, what are some unique challenges facing education in Alabama?
I won't argue that it's all that unique to Alabama, but one of the challenges of education is to make sure that we are providing an education that will lead to academic success for all of our students, and that would include students from high poverty backgrounds, students who may be English language learners, students who may have disabilities. So that's an important challenge, I think, for us in general, as well as in the state of Alabama.
Any thoughts?
Well, I don't think it's unique to Alabama, but I think one of the challenges that we face is definitely funding to make sure that we could properly fund those education initiatives that are put out by the state and also at the national level to make sure that the programs that our children need in school are fully funded. We talk a lot about tutoring that our, you know, some of our students need. Maybe some of our classes are overcrowded, which according to, you know, the Alabama formula for providing teachers may need to be tweaked a little bit to make sure that those class sizes are as small as possible. But in order to do that, we have to have more funding to put more teachers in place. So I think definitely funding will be right at the top as one of those obstacles that we face.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Voltz.
And as we speak about more teachers, one of the things that we'll have to consider is the demographics of the teaching profession. We'll have lots of folks probably who will be transitioning out. At the same time that we are somewhat challenged in encouraging our 18, 19, 20-year-olds to consider teaching as a profession. That's one of the things that I think will be an important challenge for us, is to make sure that our young people recognize the importance and the power of being a teacher.
I think Alabama is going in the right direction as far as thinking that students, it's not one size fits all anymore. For example, in my system, I'm in the career technical section, and we have homeschool students that co-op and come to the STEM Academy. And they compete with our robotics program. And there are students that are just not going to go to college, but they might go through a technical school and get certification. And some of those students, my former students, make, you know, more money than I do, and they only have 2 years of college. And some just have certifications.
Right.
So I think Alabama's moving in that direction, where it's not one size fits all, and we're becoming more flexible.
And would you attribute that? I've been hearing that a lot, too. Would you attribute that to leadership at the state level?
Yeah. Dr. Bias is a huge proponent of career technical education.
And speaking of realistic approaches, Jerry, I have a question for you. As someone who's at the interface of schools and parents, of schools and homes, given all the social and technological shifts in recent years that undeniably affect education, do we as a society, taxpayers, the media, parents, politicians, do we simply expect too much from our schools?
I don't think you can expect too much. You know, I've heard educators say that children will rise to what you expect from them. So you expect great things from them. They will perform at exceptional levels. So I don't think it's expecting too much, but I think that we are lacking in providing them the resources to be able to produce those results. If we want stellar programs in all of our schools, and we need to properly fund it. If we want all of our kids to, you know, to come out of high school making 25, 30 on the ACT, then we need to make sure that we have the programs in place to be able to do that. So I don't think our expectations are too high, but once we set those expectations out there to make sure that we have the mechanism in place to make sure that those programs and those initiatives are properly funded. You know, I hear from teachers a lot that, you know, we put those mandates out there, but they're not backed up by the resources to be able to fully implement those. So we as educators and parents also have to be able to do that and not make any excuses, but we need to make sure that we are properly, and it goes back to funding, to make sure that we are properly funding those initiatives and those mandates that we put out there.
Right. Isn't that a very fine line to walk? Because as a teacher, you cannot make excuses for kids. You can't say, oh, he or she is poor, comes from what used to be called a broken home, and therefore you have lowered expectations. You can't do that. That's unfair to those kids. At the same time, though, the reality is some of these kids, they're coming in hungry, whatever. Isn't that a very, very hard sort of perfect balance to shoot for?
But it helps when the school, when the parents and the teachers and the administrators are working together to look at realistically what can we achieve. You know, if their kids are only going to move so much academically within a year, so looking at where they are, assessing the students to see at what level they're performing at, and to see how far we can move the dial. But if the school and the home is working together, I think we can set realistic expectations to make sure that our children are being successful.
You just heard from Jerry Tate, president of the Phillips Academy PTA. You're listening to 90.3 WBHM and 91.5 WSGN. This is Issues and Ails, brought to you by WBHM and the Southern Education Desk. I'm Dan Carson. We're also talking with Jemison High School teacher Brooke Elliott, homeschooled freshman Claire Rivas, and UAB School of Education Dean Dr. Deborah Voltz. Schools are funded through a complex and diverse mix of federal, local, and state money. For practical reasons, I'd like to focus on state funding right now. Media outlets have reported on both the inequity and the inadequacy of our state's funding formula. Do you agree with the gist of those reports, that inequitable, inadequate state funding is a serious issue?
Yes.
Okay, could you elaborate a little bit, please?
Yes. If you know, I'm haven't been in Birmingham all of my life, from Marengo County, and the funding formula in Alabama is based, a lot of it is based off of property tax. Right. And if you go to a county like Marengo County, which a lot of the people do not own property, well, how are they going to have the funds to be able to fit into that formula? And then if you come to a city like Birmingham, where the property taxes may be low, well, that means that the funding for our students is going to be lower. But then if you go to a city like Mountain Brook, where the property tax is higher, then the students in that particular city are going to receive more funding. So I think it definitely needs to be tweaked to make sure that all of our children have the same opportunity to succeed, realizing that we may have to pour more resources into those areas that are lacking. I know we have some federal funding that does that, but we can't rely on that. That the state has to take the initiative and to rectify that situation.
Any other thoughts on that?
I believe the amount is about $300 per student, and when you are in those Mountain Brook areas and they have more of the local funding, they're able to hire more teacher units. And so therefore their class sizes are lower. I just happen to come from a district where we have zero local funding for my school. So our class sizes are 34 to 36 students in a class.
And what grade levels are that? Is that across the board, 9 through 12?
Like you said, if it was based on a tax rate where everyone was equal and the state was able to give more funding so that we could have higher teacher units in those counties that have lower property taxes, then our class sizes would go down, teachers would be happier, we could focus more on the student individual need instead of trying to have such a large variety of learning curves, learning abilities. I have an engineering lab where, you know, we're building robots, and if they're elbow to elbow, they can't really build a robot in the time that I'm allowed to have them do it. So as far as the local funding, if we could figure out some way to increase the state allotment for each student, that would help those counties better.
Right, where there's very little property tax or sales tax base or whatever the case may be.
We just became a Title I school this year, so we're very excited. We're happy to do the paperwork. We were able to buy new computers. We were working off of computers, and I'm the technology coordinator there, so I was repairing 10-year-old computers to try to do all the state testing that are online, and it was almost impossible, and we were very frustrated. So we were lucky to get the Title I money this year. So we do rely on the federal government in those lower counties.
Interesting. Thank you. Charter schools are public schools that are free from some of the rules and regulations that apply to standard public schools. Charter schools are now legal in Alabama. It'll be a couple years before any are up and running, but it's pretty safe to say they're coming. So do you think charter schools are a good fit for Alabama? Sorry to drop the bomb, but...
One of the things about charter schools is that I think they could have some opportunities for us, and I look forward to see the kinds of partnerships that do emerge. One of the things that I find somewhat encouraging about, I guess, the Alabama way in terms of charter schools is that, as I understand it, public charter schools will have some similar obligations as schools in general, in the sense that they won't be able to cherry pick, you know, that they will have to, for example, be open to students with disabilities as well as typically performing students. So that piece is good. I guess, as always, funding has sort of been a constant little theme in the comments that have been made thus far. And so I think that it's appropriate to acknowledge that we have to, I guess, balance the potential benefits of allowing for innovation, experimentation, that kind of stuff. And I see that as a possibility under the charter school movement. We have to balance that against possible, I guess, downside of funding that may be funneled away from some of the schools that are the most challenged. So I guess we have to find a way to do that so that we don't hurt some students in the process.
Any other thoughts on that?
I think it's about charter schools probably is about maybe 5 years behind or too late, because with the initiative that Dr. Weiss and the state are making available for school systems now, you know, there are a lot of options for schools and for systems to take. You look at the Woodlawn Innovation Network, where they applied for a waiver from the state to be able to do some unique things within that particular feeder pattern. It's going to work out well for the student. There are a lot of opportunities now that are available to our to the current public education system that we didn't have 5 years ago. So a lot of those options and those things that would be available in a charter school are now available in the public school.
You know, interesting, the flexibility that you mentioned that the state is now allowing, a lot of that comes from the original parts of the Alabama Accountability Act before it sort of became something else. So
right.
I'm not going to drop that on you. We're going to get into that in the next panel. So I have one more question before we move on to the audience questions. Can you name one or two things that make you optimistic about education in Alabama?
This event, I think that the community at large recognizes the importance and have mobilized to enhance educational opportunities for all of our children. And so you see coalitions like Bold Goals, for example, that brings in, I don't know, scores of groups from across the region to think about and to put resources behind innovations that can move us forward in that way. So going back at least as far as yes, we can, I mean, I think the community has demonstrated its commitment to the goal of providing solid educational opportunities for all of our children. So I think that's very encouraging.
Next.
I'm a part of a program called Project Lead the Way, and this program partners with different school of engineering around the country. And these teachers are trained, and it's almost like boot camp for 2 weeks. And we live and breathe those engineering courses. And I have seen great strides in my students when it's all inquiry-based, project-based learning. It's not the teacher standing up telling the students their knowledge. It's giving them a task, letting them try it. If it doesn't work, they try it again, they redesign, and they come up with their own product, and they feel like they are a big part of their education. And that has been very successful at Jemison. And I know that Auburn University is one of them that deals with the School of Engineering. And I've attended the University of South Carolina and done some training there. In my opinion, after teaching 13 years with the old-fashioned one-size-fits-all core subject and going into this, it's exciting. And as a teacher teaching 17 years, you know, I'm excited again.
That's great to hear. Someone else, I'd actually like an answer from each of you on this. What makes you optimistic about the future of education in Alabama?
Well, I think that homeschooling actually is kind of what this whole future is kind of heading towards. Kids are going to be able to try, and they're going to be able to do what they think that they're going to be interested in, like homeschoolers have been all these years, and they're going to be able to try new things, and they may not like it, and that's okay, and they'll be able to go, and they'll be able to try something else, and they'll be able to succeed and go on and do whatever they need to do in their life.
Great. Thank you, Jerry.
Well, I see kids every day, and they love it. They're excited about going to school. The small ones are really, really, really excited. They run in. But even the ones that are in high school, I see them in the morning, and they are excited about going to school and about learning. But also, I think education is the way. It's going to solve a lot of our issues that we face today. It's going to solve our issue with poverty. It's going to solve our issue with crime. It's going to solve a lot of our economic issue in Birmingham. You know, if we get the education level up, we'll see the property value will go up. We'll see that our city will start to flourish. We'll also see that the crime rate will start to go down, and we'll also see that a lot of our kids will be more excited. So I think that I'm really excited about the future. Kids are really, really excited about what education looks like today as opposed to when I was coming up. It looks a lot different. It's more fun, more interactive, and I think they're learning a lot more.
All right, thank you. You're listening to Issues and Ales on WBHM, taped live on Thursday, November 5th at WorkPlay in Birmingham. I'm Dan Carson. And now we have time for just a few questions from the audience. For Dr. Volz and Ms. Elliott, how do we combat negative stereotypes of the teaching field in order to recruit?
I think that's an excellent question. What I think we should do is to help lift up all the wonderful work that teachers are doing in classrooms each and every day. I think sometimes we may pick up outliers, or we may like to focus on the parts that we aren't quite as good as we'd like to be. And don't get me wrong, there is nothing wrong with being introspective, being reflective, looking at where you can grow. That's all a part of achieving excellence. So I'm not suggesting that we should not do that, or we should not make it public. But what I think we need to do is to make it more balanced and make it more reflective of what the reality actually is. And we as educators, I think we have to take some responsibility for that, to tell you the truth. So I think making sure that we celebrate our successes as publicly as we acknowledge our challenges, I think that's going to be a big part of it. And as we do that more, I think it will become contagious. So as you're working with your 18, 19-year-olds and they're thinking about careers, if they say, well, you know, I think I might want to be a teacher, you won't say, oh, no, let's let's reconsider that.
I recently watched a video on social media that was a parody of teaching, and the title was, "What Would Teaching Be Like If You Were Rock Stars or Athletes?"
And was that Key and Peele?
I think so. But it was great to watch that, because if students really valued the educators' education as they do their heroes for athletes and rock stars, then the perception would change. That would be one piece. And I think the other piece would be making sure that all stakeholders are involved in that child's education. We have surveys that go out from schools. We have ways that from PTO that parents can have an active role. I know at several schools we have parent education. So the parents come in and for example, if they do internet safety, they come and educate them on that. And I just think getting them involved, especially at the high school level, will help in giving them an opportunity to have a first step in their child's education will help that perception to go up.
All right, well, thank you. We could probably go all night on audience questions alone, but the bell is about to ring on this session. I'd like to thank all the panelists for joining us today and for their very educational responses. Jemison High School teacher Brooke Elliott, homeschooled student Claire Rivas, PTA leader Jerry Tate, and UAB Education School Dean Dr. Deborah Volz. We'll continue the discussion in just a moment. I'm Dan Carson, and you're listening to Issues and Ails, the Future of Education in Alabama, on your NPR News Station, 90.3 WBHM and 91.5 WSGN.
This is Issues and Ails, the Future of Education in Alabama, presented by WBHM and the Southern Education Desk. I'm Cheryl Wheeler-Stewart, Managing Editor on the Southern Education Desk, and I'd like to welcome all of our panelists for this very important discussion on education. I'd like to introduce to you Mr. J.W. Carpenter. He is Executive Director of the Birmingham Education Foundation and was the founding Executive Director for Teach for America Alabama. Carpenter serves on the boards of A-Plus Education Partnership, Operation Hope Alabama, and Youth Entrepreneurial Labs. We also have Reverend John McDonald. He's the Director of Catholic Education and Lifelong Formation for the Diocese of Birmingham, Alabama Catholic Schools. Father McDonald is also the President of John Carroll High School and pastor of St. Aloysius in Bessemer. We have Mr. Aubrey Miller, President of the Shelby County School Board. He has been Director of Tourism for the state of Alabama, and most recently he served as Executive Director for the Alabama Chapter of Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. He is an ordained minister and pastor of Faith Church in Oxmoor Valley. Unfortunately, Elliot Spillers, who is the SGA president at the University of Alabama, could not be with us tonight. Mr. Thomas Raines of Alabama A-Plus Partnership has agreed to step in as a panelist for us. Of course, Mr. Raines is well-versed in education issues in the state and will be using his expertise on the panel along with our other distinguished guests. We'll get right to the questions. My first question is for Father McDonald. Through the Alabama Accountability Act, students can get financial support to attend schools outside of their typical public schools assignment, including private, parochial, and out-of-zone public schools. Some observers say this has the potential for boosting students' academic achievement. Others say it just drains public schools. What do you think?
So the Catholic Church in North Alabama has served impoverished communities for 175 years. And so this has been a primary mission for us. And we're certainly happy that now the state of Alabama has recognized something that we have taught from the beginning, that the parent is actually the mover in education in the United States of America. For many people, I think the playing field of education is made clearer when we look at some major Supreme Court decisions in the United States of America. In 1925, some people in the state of Oregon sued the Sisters of the Holy Names of Jesus and Mary, so they were pretty brave, because they said that in the state of Oregon, the state had the right to educate every child in high school, and that no other schools could exist in the state of Oregon. And this Supreme Court decision is Pierce versus the Society of Sisters of the Holy Names of Jesus and Mary. The Supreme Court found that in the United States of America, an essential principle of education is that the parent can decide what type of education their child receives. The Alabama Accountability Act is, for the first time in the state of Alabama, giving legislative acknowledgement of this fact. It's a very important thing for us to realize that the state, whereas it has a legal obligation to educate, actually, though, cannot replace the parent as the primary mover. So many arguments can be made about the economic situation or the educational outcomes, but those arguments are all secondary to the fact that the parent has a right in the Constitution to choose what type of education their child receives. And the state has to recognize that and then, in my opinion, provide funds which support the parent's choice.
Would either of you like to chime in on that?
So what I'd say is, first of all, two parts of the Accountability Act. The first part was about flexibility and granting flexibility to our school districts. I am for granting our school districts a wide range of flexibility as long as there's accountability along with it. And I think that was a good first step, but I'd like to see a lot more flexibility for our school districts to innovate like we're seeing in Talladega, like we're seeing in Huntsville, like we're seeing in great school districts across the state. The second part was about the funding portion of it. And what I'd say is I think that we need to be doing innovation, but we don't have enough money generally. And with any time that we are trusting money to anyone in this state or trusting our students, we need accountability. That's true for our school districts. It's also true for the folks who are receiving this funding. And so what I want to see is the schools that receive the money under the Accountability Act, how's it going? Are they doing well? Are they serving the students? It's the same question we should be asking anyone and any entity that is serving our students and taking state money, especially if they are doing both at the same time.
I'm going to move on to the next question. Mr. Carpenter, you were just speaking, and I have another one for you. Alabama has a goal of having its students college and career ready when they graduate. What can the business community do in helping to reach that goal? And what can the general community do in reaching that goal?
The first thing is we have to understand that goal. Up till now, we focused on one goal, and the output has been high school degree, a high school degree. And what we, I think, realize now, especially as we've dropped the standards for a high school degree in the state of Alabama, that a high school degree, one, is not going to cut it, and two, as we're seeing students cross the stage at multiple school districts, a high school degree means different things. So we have to define what college and career ready mean, and we have to make sure that we're giving our students and the two most important groups to them, their families and their educators, the resources they need to get college and career ready. That means making sure they have the resources for our students to get benchmark ACT scores or benchmark work key scores or AP credit, like the great stuff that A+ is doing, or our dual enrollment credit and down the line. In terms of the business community, we see it in Birmingham all the time. Our business community has a ton of expertise to offer, but what I want them to do and what I've seen them do time and time again in Birmingham is show up and ask this question: what can I do to help? Don't show up and say, this is what you do. Because the most important word I'll say tonight, the most important word I'll ever say is four letters, W-I-T-H, with. We must do things with our communities. That's especially true in our low-income communities where they are too used to things being done to them or for them. We must do things with them, working with our students, with our teachers, with our families, and with the community leaders who are already doing very hard work. When we do things with each other, when we build that network, when we hold our students to high expectations that are meaningful and measurable, we see wins.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. Mr. Miller, I now have a question for you. As president of the Shelby County School Board, so public school boards each year approve budgets for their systems, and usually one of the biggest hurdles is making the ends meet. What is the biggest financial hurdle faced by our public school boards today in Alabama?
Thanks. I think there are two. They're very difficult to get over kind of hurdles. And the first is the uncertainty of state funding. It is a terrible political issue. And it is difficult to make plans about your financial future when you have a multimillion dollar budget and the education of significant numbers of students is at stake, and the compensation of faculty and staff members, support staff, etc. And it is very, very difficult when you are very uncertain as to what the state is going to do in terms of funding in a particular year, whether you're going to get funding or whether you're going to get a big, big surprise in the form of something federal like sequestration, or you're going to get some other kind of holdbacks from the state. The other factor is the uncertainty of the economy as a whole. We depend significantly in Shelby County, as other school systems do, on property taxes for our funding. And if there is a bump in the economy and property taxes go down because people are not able to buy homes and they move into the area because they want access to the educational facilities but are unable to purchase a home in the area, well, they rent. And it does not positively impact the budget perspective of the school system. So what we have done in Shelby County, and I'm sure other smart systems do the same thing, is we operate well within and under our means so that if there comes a time when there is proration, or if there is a dive in the economy, we're prepared to handle those financial ends not meeting by attrition, so that we don't have to lay people off, so that we don't have to cut programs, so that we don't have to see a suffering in our professional development of our academic staff. So that's the way we approach it. But you're right to ask the question, because it is a critical issue, and it is a critical factor for the Board of Education as we structure the budget every year.
Do any of the other panelists have thoughts on school finance that causes concern?
For me, not being in a public system, you know, I sit here and I just think, wow, I wish I had all this money that the public school has. Because we have run a school system where 25 to 40% of the children in any given Catholic school in North Alabama live at or below the poverty level. So that means that our students, really for all intents and purposes, even before the Accountability Act, paid very small tuitions, some as little as $50 a month, to attend a Catholic school, which are all fully accredited and provide a high-level, high-quality educational product. We do that because people like me go out and beg. We beg. We go out in the street, we go to businesses, we go to whomever we can find to beg to provide this level of education. And so for us, the use of the dollar is sacred, not just because it's a Catholic school, but because it was also hard to come by. So there is also a human capital that is involved for us in making our funds produce the highest level of outcomes that we can possibly produce. So for us, the whole idea of the management of funds and the amount, of course, everything's better with a lot of money, Lord. But at the same time, when you have scarce resources, there is a human capital and a type of other resources that come in which can still affect student outcomes. And that is something that we often need to focus on, the fact that we are here to meet the needs of the children. So sometimes a little bit of scarcity can actually produce a great outcome from time to time.
Is it the amount of money you have to run a particular school or educational operation, or is it what you do with those funds? What makes the greatest impact?
In our last panel, the question was, you know, when will the level of funds be enough? Some might say never. So the question really becomes, what do you do with those funds?
So let me just jump in here and say I have the proud owner of two Catholic degrees and think the world of the church and the education that I received. I would not, and I do agree that we need to be accountable for our money. We need to spend it intelligently. And if we want more of it, which I think we need more of it, we need to be accountable, not just for how we spend it, but for our student results. Where I would push back on you is I would not call the money I see in education and the money I see specifically in the Birmingham City Schools, I would not use the word abundance. And I would also say that a lot of the times, while there is more money, there are also a lot more students and there are more responsibilities and there are more mandates. So We're comparing apples and oranges a little bit here. And I am for, you know, more money and more accountability, especially to student outcomes. There I agree. But I think we should be careful about what we're, how we're describing these things.
And I would just like to add to that. We have to stand back for a minute and ask ourselves, what are we failing to do because we don't have the funds to do it? Let's use a hypothetical county, and let's just say there's an east and a west, and let's just say that the east is very rural, and let's just say that the west is suburban, and it is supported by property taxes over there, and in the rural area, you got two different worlds, and it is that way in many counties and many school districts in Alabama. So we need to be able to dream about the greater good for the greater number of families, students, teachers. And we have to understand that the success of the school system, whether it's Catholic or whether it's urban or whether it's suburban, it really doesn't matter. We're all in it together. And the success of education in Alabama determines the success of the economy in Alabama.
Thank you so much, Mr. Miller. Mr. Raines, I have a question for you. As a representative of Alabama A-Plus Partnership, you've had an opportunity to look throughout the state at the big picture of educational needs, especially as it relates to lifting student performance. If there was something that you could do differently, or if there is something you would like to see done differently on a statewide level to raise the achievement of our children, what would it be?
Sure. So let me start by saying I think that Alabama has made a great start with Plan 2020, the State Board of Education's strategic plan to move to a 90% graduation rate and making sure students graduate college and career ready. But I think that's only part of the issue. And there are truly two things that I see right now that would lead to dramatic improvement for education in Alabama. The first one is going to sound incredibly nerdy, but I'm a policy wonk, and that's what I do all the time, so it is nerdy. It's putting in place a state longitudinal data system. And right now in Alabama, we are one of four states that has no governing body, no person, no one watching the entire educational spectrum, from pre-K through graduate school. If you go into pre-K, you're overseen by the Department of Early Childhood Education. K-12 is the Department of Education. There's post-secondary that handles two-year schools, and the four-year schools are all governed by their own boards of trustees. And there is no way to link the data on how students are performing from pre-K into K-12 into two-year to four-year schools. That leads to tremendous breaks in what we're able to do with students. You see students showing up unready for school, who aren't school ready in kindergarten. You see huge enrollments in ninth grade because they're not ready for high school, the rigor of high school when they get there. You see students dropping out before they graduate. And then, of course, you see a third of the students who go to college in Alabama end up in remedial classes. So they're taking classes to reteach things that they were supposed to learn in high school. So that's one of the things, a state longitudinal data system that would be able to allow us to link data and look at how students are performing across the spectrum and see where those breaks in the pipeline are to make sure that those students are being well served. The other issue is teacher quality. We have got to do a better job in Alabama recruiting, training, mentoring, and supporting our teachers that are in the classroom. There's a great mentoring program that helps pair teachers, new teachers, with veteran teachers to help make sure they can improve their craft, providing more professional development. And all of this stuff can help raise the level of performance for our teachers that are in the classroom and improving the ones who are soon going to come into the classroom.
Thank you all very much. Let me remind you that you are listening to Issues and Ails, the Future of Education in Alabama, on WBHM 90.3 Birmingham and WSGN 91.5 Gadsden. We've been listening here to Mr. J.W. Carpenter of the Birmingham Education Foundation, Mr. Thomas Raines of the Alabama A-Plus Partnership, Father John McDonald, Director of Education for the Catholic Diocese of Birmingham, and Mr. Aubrey Miller, President of the Shelby County Board of Education. Earlier this year, the Southern Education Desk had an opportunity to do a series on charter schools. We looked at charter schools in Alabama, what the future might hold. We looked at the situations that have occurred in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Tennessee. We know that probably within 2 years, charter schools will be a reality here. So I'd like to ask our panelists, when you think about what you have observed personally as it relates to the achievement of our students, the support for our teachers, what impact, if any, do you feel charter schools would have on the state?
Full disclosure, A-Plus has been a proponent of charter schools for many years, and we were pleased to see the law pass in March to allow public charter schools in Alabama. I sit on the Public Charter School Commission, which is a newly created board that will serve as an appellate board for applications denied by local districts. We see charter schools as a way of fostering innovation in education. You can hear, you can talk to a lot of people about a lot of different reasons why they think charter schools need to be out there. We see it as a way of opening the doors for innovation that can improve all schools. If you look in particular at two different places that I like to use as examples, Houston took best practices from high-performing charter schools and implemented them back into their traditional public schools as a way of making their traditional schools better. Up in Chicago, the University of Chicago created the Urban Education Institute to study what works best for serving students in urban situations. I think those are two examples and part of what UEI does at University of Chicago is operate a four-campus charter school for predominantly low-income students across Chicago. Those are two examples that I think show the great opportunity.
Would anyone else like to respond?
I think that charter schools, at the end of the day, is simply an issue of governance. You know, innovation in governance, too, that there's more local autonomy, which is always helpful. And I think in the state of Alabama, the more diverse that our educational landscape is, the more that our students will benefit. As J.W. mentioned about meeting the needs of our students, the things that they're interested in, the conversation with them, as long as we support this type of diversity in providing all sorts of outlets for whatever it is that people feel that meets their needs, then we improve education in Alabama for all. This is a partnership between all different levels of education. Charter schools in particular, I think in the state of Alabama, will be helpful, particularly if they can reach out successfully in rural areas. That is a big challenge in the state of Alabama, because even with the Accountability Act, acknowledging that they're not always even access to non-traditional public schools in rural areas.
What I'd say is this. First thing I'd say is we just passed one of, if not the very best and strictest charter school authorizing law in the country. It's going to be very, very hard. You're going to have to meet a very high burden to get a charter school. And if you do not show results, you can lose that charter. And what we've seen around the country is when charters are held to high standards, they do a really good job. Where we've seen weaker authorizing laws, you've seen some weaker charter schools. But I have visited charter schools that are changing children's lives for the better. And I've read about charter schools that are doing a real disservice as well. It's a mixed bag. And I would say there isn't a system on earth, Catholic schools, traditional public schools, public charter schools on earth, that don't have great schools and bad schools. And what I'd say is, I want kids to go to a great school. And the reason why we at the Ed Foundation work with the Birmingham City Schools is I think I've got partners at those schools and partners in that district who want the exact same thing, and we love working with them. But I'd say if charter schools can come under this authorizing law and they can meet the standards for authorization and show great results for kids, welcome. Catholic schools, if you can do that, welcome. Private schools, if you could do that, welcome. I want every kid to sit in a seat in a school where they're getting a high-quality education. Because I come from complete and total privilege, that's what I got my whole life. And I shouldn't just get it because I come from complete and total privilege. Let's give it to everyone, and if charters can help, let's go.
We consistently see reports that point to a disparity in the achievement among students in some urban, rural, suburban, and affluent communities. This is most often referred to as an achievement gap. Is this real? And is the solution something that should be handled on a state or local level, or should it be addressed primarily through national initiatives?
Absolutely, the achievement gap is real. It has been there probably as long as education in the United States has existed. I am going to go out on a limb and say something that not many people will say, but one of the big benefits of the No Child Left Behind law, and there were not many, but one of the big benefits of the No Child Left Behind law was that it allowed for disaggregation of student data. And we started to see in a real black and white manner, with hard numbers, that children in low-income communities, children, people of color, are not being given the same educational opportunities that others are. Yes, the achievement gap is real. It exists for low-income students. It exists across racial differences. It exists in some cases between male and female students. And it all goes back to the expectations we hold of what students can do. Short answer is yes, it exists, and yes, we can deal with it, but we're not doing enough yet.
It's real. It's not seen as a high priority in some facets of the education community, and it needs to be a high priority goal. It needs to be a critical success factor. And as Mr. Raines indicated, it is along, as it always has been, along socioeconomic bounds, racial bounds, and increasingly upon ethnic origin bounds. And it's critical, and not enough attention is being paid to it as being a real factor.
I've heard it referred to as achievement gap. I know when I started in this work, I referred to it as achievement gap. I got no problem with it being referred to as achievement gap. I like the term opportunity gap. I think that our students and every student that I've ever met in any community has limitless potential. Limitless potential. I work with talented students every single day, and the great educators that I work with and get to work with and privileged to work with believe the same thing and are doing incredible stuff. But they oftentimes, when we cut along income, sometimes racial, certainly geographic lines, have limited opportunities.
The empowerment of the teacher at the local level, I think, is the most powerful force. The power of the teacher is such that it can affect change, particularly in regards to the achievement gap. So when we empower the teacher at the local level, particularly with their own gifts and talents that they bring in that individual classroom for the individual student, recognizing the individual student's needs and abilities, I think that's where we really make traction in that work of closing any kind of gap that we find when we go to work as a teacher.
You have been listening to Issues and Ails, the Future of Education in Alabama, on WBHM 90.3 FM and WSGN 91.5. Thank you so very much for your participation this evening, and we encourage you to continue listening to WBHM. Thank you.
Issues and Ails, the Future of Education in Alabama, was produced by Rachel Lindley, Cheryl Wheeler-Stewart, Audrey Atkins, and me, Dan Carson, with support from the Southern Education Desk, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Daryl McCalla and Matt Diffie provided technical support with additional help from the WBHM staff. Our general manager is Scott Hanley. Thanks for listening.